It's a little bit further down the road, McNeil Tulloch report.
Well, I think the key to this is that it's the criticisms that come out of the Crimea and the related problems there. And in a way, the ideas of radical reform are that the officer corps is too restrictive. The purchase system remains. You can buy rank. You can buy your progress up the scale. But then there's, once you've got to a certain level up to lieutenant colonel, then it's by semi-seniority and so on, that the high command is very, very ossified, is not open to new talent. And the army is not recruiting able people at every level, if you like. Now, obviously, you've got officer training, but there's limited training for the ordinary soldiers and so on. So I think it's partly that kind of reaction against the problems in the Crimea that the British do find it difficult to keep the army in the Crimea going during the winter of 1854 to 1855. Now, some of that criticism is unfair because they'd sent a small force to the Crimea, not envisaging that it would be there during the winter. The Crimea is actually a sort of holiday resort place. Most of the time, it's a nice, easy climate, but they faced a particularly harsh winter, and they didn't cope with it very well in terms of supplies, clothing, and all the rest of it. So I think the reforms are partly that. They're provoked by a particular short-term crisis in the Crimea. They are about manpower training, but they're also about the organisation of supplies and how those organisations in London operate. And not very well was the argument in 1854-55. As I say, I think there is an unfairness there because it's a small army task suddenly with a much bigger task than ever thought it would face in the Crimea. And there is reorganisation, clearly to do with supply, the ordnance, supply of equipment and uniforms, blankets, stuff like that, food. But I think the more significant one is probably the Cardwell reforms of the early 1870s, where you end the business of purchasing of rank. You have a fully recruited officer corps, and you get a much stronger attempt to treat the ordinary soldiers more effectively. The length of service is reduced. I mean, back in the old days, service was basically for life. You now move to 6-year or 12-year lengths of service in the regular army, with then going into the reserves. So I think you get a sense that the army is not a lifelong commitment, much more of a job which people can slip into and then get out of, and so on. It's an attempt to make soldiering more respectable, if you like, for ordinary people. I'm not sure it works, because even by the 1890s, there's a view that being an ordinary soldier is a pretty grim task. I mean, the other point to remember, of course, is that there is an attempt to improve barracks and to provide for much more agreeable places to live. I mean, the barracks argument had come in during the Napoleonic Wars, that you wanted to house soldiers apart from a civilian population. Soldiers up to then were just put into digs in pubs and so on, stuff like that, inns. The provision of barracks comes in the Napoleonic Wars, but it's expanded. I mean, you take industrial cities in the 1850s, and for many of them, the biggest buildings in those industrial cities were actually the barracks on the edges of the cities and so on. But you do get things like, you know, the improvement of food, provision of better meals, provision of libraries, so soldiers can do something other than get drunk, you know, provision of savings banks, so they don't just spend their money when they receive it, but they can positively save it. So I think in those circumstances, you get a changing environment for the ordinary soldier, and there's a greater emphasis on temperance and attempt to improve behaviour. But I think the key is recruitment and the possibility of making the army a short service career so that it isn't seen as a life sentence to go into the army. And that's the key to the changes going on. But it still remains a regimental army and a small army.